Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What's up, everyone? It's another exciting edition of Nothing Urgent.
Titillating.
We're joined here today by Aaron Short, once again, who joined us earlier to discuss the primaries. Now he's here after post-election to break down last night's mayoral and other electorate.
Spoken like a true informed voter.
Post-election surgery.
Yes. Ian Vanek from Japanther is also here, and he'll be... You could say hello.
Hello.
Thank you. And he'll be with us throughout the show. And Todd Seeley, the photographer, sucker pants, blogster.
Yeah, he shoots for Gothamist, too.
Yeah.
He shoots for everyone. He's great.
He shot for Impos before Gothamist. I just like to point that out.
Well, and
you guys steal all of our photographers because you could pay for them. But,
so
but still, I just want to say that you steal. No.
So noted.
But he'll be here to discuss his new book, Bright Lights, Photography of Another New York. Or is it Photographs? Photographs. Yeah, you know. You take notes,
whatever.
And you can barely
read. Yeah.
And Japanther's actually playing one of his release shows as well.
Yeah, so. That's right. Tomorrow night. That's
tomorrow. See Synergy. Yeah. Symmetry. What's the word I'm looking for?
Synergy.
Yeah, that was the right word.
Yeah.
Anyway, Synergy. Aaron.
What's going on?
How exciting was last night?
We have New York has its first Hare Krishna mayor.
I heard he was a communist, actually.
Well, you know, whatever. Yeah, so it was. I went to a few polling stations. I did not vote. Because I'm not registered in New York City.
I will say this, Virginia. It was much easier to vote yesterday.
Yeah, your race was, the governor's race there was more interesting than the mayor's race here.
Barely.
Yeah, it was a low bar for both.
But it was, it's the lowest turnout in how many years, right? I don't know, that stat just came out. It was something like 28% of all registered voters.
Well, it took me, I had to wait in line about 45 minutes to an hour during the presidential election. Last night, I just walked right up. Signed my name, voted, and left. So
there was more interest in the primary. You had more people running. This time, Bill de Blasio, who's our new mayor, won by, we got
49%.
49, yeah, it was like 50%. He doubled them up, you know, more so. He won by like 50 points. And it was a landslide, and I think people didn't want to vote for Loda, the Joe Loda, who's the opponent, the main opponent.
Distant relative of Ray Loda, I heard.
Maybe, you know, from the same village.
Yeah, okay, so what does all this malaise tell us? I mean, really? I mean, de Blasio today used the word mandate twice at a press conference, that he has a mandate. I mean, is 28% of the voting population a mandate?
I think I don't think so. I think once he gets into City Hall and figures out all, you know, the budgetary problems that the city's going to face in the next couple of years, you know, that mandate goes away pretty quickly. His other big problem, in addition to, like, financial issues that the city's facing, is inaction in Albany. And a lot of the policies that he wants to get done, he actually has to get the entire state legislature and the governor to go along with him. Or, you know, majority of that.
Could you sort of elaborate on that? The largest one being raising
taxes on the wealthy New Yorkers for universal kindergarten or universal pre-kindergarten for New York City kids.
Those 4-year-olds. Why don't they line my pocket with some taxpayer money?
you want some juice and some nap time?
Yeah,
state paid for.
I mean, you know,
time?
People and
how
people
about health
in Albany,
insurance? Yeah, that's another discussion.
People anyway. In Albany generally support universal pre-K. The Assembly does,
but don't you feel like it's kind of not?
But they don't. But they don't like tax increases. So you've got both of these things sort of crashing. They definitely don't like tax increases in an election year, when the governor's on the ballot.
Right, that's
so
a big part of it.
Governor doesn't want to run, you know, with an opponent saying he raised taxes to work, you know, to appease New York City residents, which a Republican probably would do. So the governor's, if he's going to do anything, they're going to try to get universal pre-K done without raising taxes in the budget.
How is that possible?
You move costs around. There's a lot of money moving around.
What would be moved? What would be sort of shifted?
Hard to say. It could be other kinds of spending. The state spends a lot of money in a lot of different areas on agencies and other social programs.
Not MTA funding, please, dear God.
Well, you know, they've taken money from the MTA in the past.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
They
please.
Tried to take $90 million from disability services this year. I think they ended up getting some kind of a cut, but restored that. So they can move money around. I don't know if they can move enough around for pre-K. You probably will see some kind of tax increase.
Do you think
eventually it just might not be this year?
What about also on the ballot yesterday was casinos legalizing gambling, right?
Right, yes.
So then that passed.
That did pass.
Okay, so what about
voted against that one?
What about taking the money from the casinos and then what about paying for pre-K with that?
Well, it's going to take a long time to build a casino. So,
oh, bullshit. Yeah, bullshit. Those casinos will be up overnight, I guarantee you.
I think it's going to take a few years for them. First you have to put out a request for proposal. Right. Then you got to, vet all the companies from Las Vegas and New Jersey and whomever else, Dubai. I don't know. Everybody's going to want
Macau.
In on this. Macau. I don't know, France, Monaco, most likely Vegas, though. It's
right.
mostly been a lot of Vegas operators that want to come into places like the Catskills upstate.
Not to cut you off, will the Indian tribes be able to submit RFPs, and would they receive favorable treatment?
They have a separate arrangement with the state to build casinos on Indian territories. So what was voted on yesterday was not that. They can sort of operate in their own universe building casinos. This is actually additional casinos in addition to the Native American casinos.
So they and would they even want to get in on this action?
They're gonna try, certainly. Okay. You might see, but this is most of those
they'd
are
probably
in,
be
like,
against it, wouldn't it? Because
Buffalo
it kind of ruins their monopoly on it to a certain extent.
I think it's
because they voted on it in Buffalo and places like that as well, and I know that a lot of them turned it down, and a lot of it was because they already have. They got a lot of backlash from the Indian casinos.
These are different geographic areas. So the way that the map's supposed to work is that the Native American casinos are not in the same counties that the legalized state casinos would be. I mean, the idea is you don't want to flood the market, but of course we could end up have that happening anyway. And the preponderance of casinos doesn't necessarily guarantee that the state is going to get the projected revenue that it expects.
Yeah,
look at Connecticut. They've had some bankruptcies
there.
Yeah,
they rarely do. It's such a flawed philosophy, and it makes me kind of angry that they want to bring them in.
Well, what you'd have to do is probably increase the number of people who are gambling.
Right.
And I am not convinced that number is going to increase.
And the people that consistently gamble are the type of people that have addiction problems. It's basically
another question. It's a tax. It's a tax on casinos are essentially a tax on a certain class of people.
Sort of.
No, they are. I mean,
they also provide an outlet for. So it's like saying, oh, drunk people are going to drink, but then they pop up way more liquor stores in poor neighborhoods. It's a little bit of a
the way that state business leaders have sold this. And they haven't done it a ton, but the way they've sold it, at least in Albany, is that they want to build a large entertainment complex with casinos being one of the draws in other areas, entertainment venues. I don't know, maybe you guys could have a Japanther multiple
no,
night
thank
venue.
No thanks.
You wouldn't
this,
want like a but, 6 month run at the Albany.
The Albany
Garter
Sands.
Belt.
No. We're not involved with the organized crime. All that stuff is like a kind of a sick symptom, and I think when you put it in poorer parts of the world, it becomes it becomes an outlet for a lot of, like you said, addiction and kind of sad things, rather than Vegas being glitter and glitz. Even Vegas has a downturn side. I think people should be so much more cautious about legalizing gambling and things like that. It's really scary. I think we should legalize weed and legalize more drugs. Mexico really quietly legalized or decriminalized all drugs recently.
Portland, Maine.
Those bills are up for discussion in Albany again next year.
I think within the next 5 years, we see the governor being brave enough to legalize weed in New York State and having a lot of land that isn't producing any money, produce a lot of money in this region. So shit like gambling is like another way to have alcohol. It's ATF, like liquor and firearms, and that shit is all dirty money, blood money, where I think that there's other forms of revenue we need to be looking into as a state. Because, you know, New York State itself is a really poor place. We lived in Troy, New York, which is right near Albany. Mm-hmm. And boy, North Troy, be careful.
I'm from Buffalo. Place. So okay, it's a wild similar, place. Yeah, similar situation. Let me ask you something about more generalized about the election. This sure. goes back to the ballot, the proposition. Is that what they're called when they have those?
Prop 1.
Yeah. So props. The one with gambling, the way they word it is it was very opinionated. As I'm reading it, it's like this will raise money for to keep property taxes low, and like I know those are like the best case scenarios, but they aren't very black and white. They're very the way they're put on the ballot seemed almost like if you didn't know enough about that going into the election. I would have been swayed to vote yes, I would say.
They snuck that in.
Because it sounds very like, oh yeah, you know, it's a fuzzy way to put it, you know?
Yeah, so the governor's people, they snuck that in, which was very smart for them. And there was a lawsuit to try to change the language of it, but it was a lawsuit didn't go through. So now we've got legislation to sort of take the power away or allow other submissions of more neutral language for ballot initiatives. So the Gunvis people are very smart when it comes to this stuff.
That's I read that. I was actually kind of a little bit taken back because, you know, I knew what they were going to have on some of the bigger propositions, but I didn't realize the word as I'm reading it. I'm like, well, you know, if I didn't know what I was voting for, I would clearly vote the other way. My other question regarding the ballot. So you get down to the lower ones and it's like, what is it? The court ones? What are those ones?
Judges.
Yeah, but what?
Judge retirements?
Yeah.
No, not that. Not the propositions. The actual people on the ballot. It's like Supreme Court clerk or something. What are the court?
Civil judges.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was like four of them, and they were all backed by both. They're running seemingly unopposed because they were backed by both Democrats and Republicans. But then the Working Families Party had these like other people, which kind of threw me for a loop because, A, you rarely see Working Party, you know, they usually, Working Family usually backs, like, you know, the Democrats. And in this one scenario where there was no opposed, you know, they were running unopposed for the most part, the Working Families Party had their own, what's the word I'm looking for?
People?
Candidates. So, A, what was that about? And B, is it bad that I voted for them?
I was going to ask you who you voted for.
Go Working Families down the line. That's basically, well, you know, except for mayor.
I don't know specifically why there were separate candidates for the WFP, for the Working Families. I know typically the Democratic Party, which has been historically, at least in Brooklyn, you know, like a corrupt machine, would the party leader would pick the Democratic candidates, basically these, you know, lawyers, whatever, would come and do their fealty to the Democratic leader. If they wanted to be a judge, they'd interview with them. There's this whole elaborate selection process where you do this interview among panels, and then some of these key Democratic activists, Democratic Party leaders, they're called like state committee members. It would pick sort of who they thought after going through some sort of a vetting process before that. Before that, historically, the party leader would just sort of like make these guys, you know, and then they would end up on the ballot. That happens.
It's pretty granular stuff here.
We're getting
in.
Well, I'm going to assume.
How judges get on? Usually, judges get on there because they're picked. It's not. I think there's very few instances where a judge will run. Right. Because the judge just wants to run and can run without the support.
It was
of the
party.
Same
thing in the. What's the one that the advocate, the one, same thing, Bill DeBlasio, same thing. It was like, oh, they're running unopposed, but there was another name under the Working Families. So I always, well, A, I was like, is it, are they ever going to kind of acknowledge a third party in any of these when they say unopposed. But also, I'm just curious, is like, did the working families make any kind of dent, do you know? Like, in terms of those races?
I don't think so. I think the broader picture with the Working Families Party is that, you know, they went all in on Tish James and Bill de Blasio before these guys were citywide candidates when they were just city council members.
Right.
And they went all in on them when they were first starting, and now they have essentially the top two offices in the city are that they are theirs. Like they made these guys essentially. So what's going to be the influence of this other party going forward? Are they going to pull Democrats to the left? You know, are they going to be able to field more candidates? Are they going to be able to run a lot more labor friendly candidates in the city now in an environment where labor is not exactly welcome, I think, in New York City, right? I
mean, well, especially now that with all the contracts coming up for renewal, it's even going to be even less favorable
and
climate.
The number of labor leaders are declining. People like companies like Cablevision are cracking down just with abandon. It's hard being pro labor in the city, even with a pro labor mayor and pro labor public advocate. And
I had a question about taxing the rich people again. Raising taxes for people who make over $500,000 might be, you know, a little politically untenable during an election year. There's a guy in the Times 2 weeks ago, their business columnist, weekly guy, who was basically saying, don't tax those people. Tax these ultra-wealthy people who live in New York City for, you know, a few hundred days a year and then leave so that they don't have to pay an income tax. In other words, these people, they're the ones buying these $95 million apartments in the sky. They're the ones who just sort of make investments in the city and sort of use the city's resources and then claim that they don't actually live here. Would that be a more politically palatable thing to tax? Yeah, like, would they go along with that versus taxing like regular New Yorkers who make $500,000 a year?
It probably would. I'm not sure why that hasn't been discussed yet. I think they're going, you know, a lot of these things are going to be on the table when it comes to tax policy. And like most tax policies, a lot of this is dependent on the state. So, you know, you're going to need to see de Blasio and his new, I guess, Albany staff lobbying the state for any kind of tax increase. Huh. So I don't think this is something you can just snap his fingers and do. I think he has to appeal to the governor and to a Republican Senate, which is against any kind of tax increase.
And I do think that the pre-K funding is kind of like a little bit of a greasing the wheels to try to put something like that through. I was going to actually mention this earlier. I mean,
by greasing the wheels, you mean?
I mean the fact that
it's like who could say no?
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's who like could say kids. No to pre-kindergarten? No, they're not even in kindergarten yet.
Well, there were a couple of columns today where reporters were interviewing like wealthy people, and they're like, I don't want to pay more taxes, even if it does, you know, fund kindergarten. So there's, you know, I like kids, but I don't want to pay more taxes.
Right,
like
right.
That kind of thing. You know, I don't. What can you do with that? Right.
No, I think
Alec Baldwin's fine with it. So,
well, he's gonna have a kid soon anyway.
He had a kid. Yeah. I think they already spit it out. Didn't
oh, really?
They?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so. Really?
Not yet.
I don't know.
But anyway, that might be why. But anyone who has like a young kid would be totally for that, right? Like, sure, why not?
I think we just reform the child labor laws here in New York City and let them work for the money. And
right. Yeah. That's what.
Let
someone
them be the blackjack dealers. Let them be these adorable
the
little blackjack
sector.
Dealers.
Now yeah. We're talking, all right? Now we're talking.
Man, they just need to have us be in there to debate these hot button issues.
Yeah, seriously.
So I need Aaron. Last time you were here, you were very. You showed absolutely no wavering in who you were voting for. Is that, do you have to keep that? Is that a job, part of your job description?
I wrote in Chris Robbins for mayor.
Thank
that'll,
you.
That'll show
finally.
Up.
yeah, come on. He can't say that. Did you vote?
Yeah, I did vote.
Okay.
I went to the party afterward. So the de Blasio party.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was disappointing.
Why was it disappointing?
Well, I will give you reasons. They had a cash bar. First of all, Loda had an open bar. He had an open bar.
Well, there's a lot less people there. How many people did you say were at the Armory?
Well, this could have been ticketed.
That's a good point. It's a good point.
A couple thousand, you know, maybe.
I know. Can't they get any liquor?
Okay, cash bar, but how much was a beer?
I don't know. I didn't checked the price. I think probably 5 or 6. It was Brooklyn. It was Brooklyn Brewery beer, and the owner of the brewery, Steve Hindy, was there, and I bet they made him buy his own beer.
Well,
right?
Yeah,
they had to. I mean, anytime you can make, you know, Steve Hindy buy his own beer, like you deserve
that. Seems like a, you know, just very cruel. Anti the message. You know, it should have been everyone should have been able to have their free beer because this rich guy owns a beer company, and you know.
Derek, you should have run on a platform of no beer over $3 in New York City. That
would have won.
Yeah, totally. I know. That's the kind of, you know, this Tale of Two Cities, they need to really, like, drive it down to a pointed message.
Tale of Beer Cities.
Yeah.
All right, so they were charging for alcohol.
Yeah.
And then what else sucked?
Oh, well, the venue was in a barn. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Park Slope Armory is a lovely place if you're, you know, like, 6 and you're playing soccer, but... to hear a big speech and the sound carries out, it's huge. Like, yeah. It's, you know, for 20,000 people, they cut it in half. Apparently, Steve Buscemi was there. He did not come on stage. He did not.
Well, like, he lives like a block away.
Yeah, so. No, it wasn't.
He's just like, what's going on here? Just stumbles in.
Apparently, Vampire Weekend was rumored to be like playing or interested in playing music. There was no music at all.
There was no music at all.
No, there was like recorded music. Oh, it was not great.
Bummer.
Yeah. I wanted Kesha. I wanted, like, a lot of Kesha in a loop, because I think that Kesha captures the qualities of our new mayor.
So what do you think?
Am I pronouncing that right, Kesha?
Yeah, of course, of course. Yeah.
I don't know how to pronounce dollar signs.
Well, yeah.
Sort of. So, all right.
Don't overthink it.
When we're in a few minutes, we're going to switch up things a little bit, but I do want to kind of get your take on what you think is going to be what we have to look forward to. I have this kind of assumption that the city's going to go through kind of like a little bit of a downturn economically, and you know, job market-wise, I don't think it's really going to trickle too far one way or the other. But I just think from the grand scheme of things, there's going to be a lot of backlash against. I am a proponent of de Blasio. I like the things that the platforms he ran on. But I think we're going to see like slight downturns and things and upticks in crime, and everyone's going to start like pointing fingers. That's my bleak outlook for the next few years.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of people are thinking that.
I want to ask how politically capable you feel de Blasio is for accomplishing his sort of agenda, and how much of it do you think he'll actually accomplish?
I think he's been underestimated for a pretty good period of his career, which is also kind of interesting, right? Like, nobody really thought he was going to win the primary except for the people around him, and he was able to benefit by a number of breaks, but some of that was also because he's a classic like political operative who's also good as a politician. So he understands sort of which way the city is moving, and he was able to sort of move his positions around like that instead of being stubborn on an issue like say the current mayor and stop and frisk. Like I think that instance of, you know,
flexibility,
right? And politicians get criticized for flip-flopping, but I think what de Blasio's doing is a little different. He's sort of very good at taking the temperature and trying to come out in front of that as well. He's also, his biggest problem is that I don't think it's actually going to be the union negotiations. I think it's going to be his base of support and the wider amount of support sort of becoming disappointed with him in the same way that, say, supporters are disappointed with Barack Obama. I think that, you know, his expectations for him are very high. It's going to be hard for him to meet that. And I don't think he's as classically the classic left-wing savior that they think he is either. And you're going to see some disappointment with that on a number of issues.
Like, he probably won't get the tax.
Like, we won't have Kick a Billionaire Wednesdays.
I was going to say Free Pizza Tuesday, but, you know.
And Stop and Frisk, too. Like, we'll see how much the police department changes.
Oh, I wanted to ask him today at the press conference whether or not he supported having a federal monitor, as the judge does, and they didn't take my question. So that's Bill de Blasio for you, hiding from the issues.
With Mayor Bloomberg at his side.
Yeah.
Were you there? Were both you guys there at the press conference with him and Bloomberg in the same room?
No, I
saw the photos.
Yeah, that's what
priceless.
Because he's 3 feet taller than him.
Well, and he was Bloomberg had like the made the mistake of crossing his arms, which he does all the time. But at the, you know, in the frame, it just looked like
bad body language.
Yeah, yeah, really bad body language.
He's like a midget, though, in real life, right?
he's a small man.
Yeah,
he's
5'7". It's not midget height. Some of us are 5'7".
We should not use the word midget. It is
not
little,
you, Aaron. You're
6'8".
You're 6'8". I want to make that clear.
Well, Aaron, thank you once again for breaking it all down for us in a way that.
Yeah, you'll have to come back when de Blasio's recalled. when the big scandal happens here in a few months.
And Ian, thank you for sitting patiently while we wait to get to you and Todd.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting stuff.
And
who's your favorite mayor of all time, New York City? Let's do a dream team. Let's do your favorite past and then favorite future. Come on.
Favorite mayor? I don't know. Everybody, I like LaGuardia, right?
He was everyone good likes LaGuardia.
Wait, was Teddy the mayor?
No, he was a police commissioner.
Highland was pretty good. He lived in Bushwick, like down the street from here, actually.
I don't know who that is.
Mayor Highland. John Highland.
He was referenced in something I saw recently, but I don't know.
Wasn't Tweed wasn't the mayor. Tweed was...
he made mayors. But
right, yeah.
All right, so then jumping to the future, like if it could be Arnold Schwarzenegger or Steve Buscemi or whoever you want, who are you going to put in office?
Uh-huh.
Dream team, like...
Dream mayor would be a really.
What do they call that?
Does Ron Perlman live in New York? No,
he can. No, this is dream team. This is like fantasy sports, you know. So
let's see.
Bloomberg was trying to get Hillary to run. That would have been really interesting.
Wow, Hitlery. That's what we call.
Yeah.
Her.
Well,
that's because she's a friend of the business community. That's what I'm kind of interested to see what happens economically because I think we're.
I think Charles Barron would be a fun mayor.
Oh
to
my
cover,
god!
Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't know. I sort of want a celebrity mayor. Is,
like
that, is that bad?
I think it's time.
Like Hugh Jackman or something?
No, like Kanye.
Paris Hilton, maybe.
I think Kanye would like take it seriously for 10% of the time.
Which is really, I mean, probably more than some other mayors we've had, really,
think
about it.
It would probably turn into like Ferris Bueller's Day Off where he'd like lead us in song all the way down the Canyon of Heroes. Where...
I'd be okay with
That'd be a good parade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd all have to wear white, though.
Well, I don't own any white, really. No white pants.
Yeah, white pants are tough. It's past Labor Day. It's after Labor Day.
It's run on the $3 beer white pants ticket.
Yeah.
White pants for every man, woman, child.
And
$3 beers.
They're slimming.
Yeah, they are slimming.
All right. All right, now that we've covered that, now we've covered our platform for mayor.
Let's listen to some music.
Yeah, I'm going to play a couple of Japanther songs. This is Stolen Flowers. This is a very recent song, right? Are you okay if I play an older song after that?
Sure. No, I'd love that. Yeah, this is a pretty recent song from our newest album. It's called Eat Like Lisa, Act Like Bart, which is the idea that you would kind of take care of your body, but you'd also be someone that was spray painting your name on your skateboard and stuff. So.
Very good reference to one of my favorite things. Mm-hmm. And we'll be back in a few weeks. Most of them are you. Set aside for the world to ignore.
Brooklyn? I don't want to go to Brooklyn.
That was an old Japanther song. That was Challenge. What was that from, like 2007, 2008?
I think 2008. It's also, what's the guy's name? Yeah, some rapper from the Bronx that we took their stuff from, Wild Style, Joe Ahern's dad's movie. It's got some lyrics in there that we borrowed.
Nice.
Appropriated.
Something like that, yeah.
So in case you're just joining us, we're joined by Ian Vanek of Japanther and Todd Seeley, a photographer at large. I'm trying to think of another way to put it. I guess that's just the way to put it.
He's an adventurer. I'll do it for you.
Yeah.
My friend Todd Seeley has been adventuring his whole life. He's from the Midwest. He's from Cleveland, Ohio. And there's all this beautiful, epic, abandoned shit out there in Cleveland. So he was snapping photos of old houses and going on road trips like you do when you're a teenager. You know, we're going to go down to Cincinnati. Cool. And we go through this abandoned building in Cincinnati. And what was the name of the old venue that was in Cleveland that you would always go to?
Speak in Tongues.
Speak in Tongues, this cool venue there. So tons of touring bands are coming through. So you see this example of like, wow, you can go anywhere. And really great photographers from that region at that time. And then he moved out to New York City, and he's been adventuring ever since with lots of people like Black Label Bike Club and Japanther and Matt and Kim and tons of great musicians and artists. So that's Todd Seeley.
That's a very good. That's a very good
intro.
I know.
Yeah, I'll take that.
No, I know. I've Todd's joining us because he just recently put out a book. It's out already, right?
Sort of. It's out, but it's hard to find. It'll be that way until probably the end of the month.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the reason why I asked you if it's out already, because I know you've already had a release party, but you're going to have another one tomorrow.
Yes. We're doing a party at Silent Barn with a bunch of my favorite bands, Japanther, So-So Glows, Unstoppable Death Machines, Ken South Rock, and Amor Obscure. And I'll also be selling copies of the book and signing them.
I know, well, we should tell everyone, the name of the book is Bright Lights, Photographs of Another New York. And it's funny because Ian kind of stole the concept I was going to roll with, because I had met you through, you know, going to shows and seeing you with other various bands. But what always struck me about your work is how you that's basically Ian summed it up you know, pretty perfectly by saying you're a traveler, because you've made so many treks. I remember just seeing like photos of you, you know, just going back and forth to like, you know, random cities along the way, like touring with bands and seeing you showing up at random cities and I think that's lost on a lot of people because they see a photographer and they're just like, oh, you know, he was just happened to be there at the time. But I don't think people realize how much actual, you know, I've seen photos of you doing, you know, what was the thing with the floating artworks in like, where was that? That was somewhere in Europe, right?
Yeah, that was on the Adriatic Sea.
Yeah, just like crazy stuff like that, that I don't think people, they just assume that you're just there at the time, you know?
I think it has a lot to do with like the Kerouac and On the Road and Beat Generation of just, there's always something to be learned about going to Venice, Italy, and throwing yourself in the mix, you know, and even if you're not invited, something will come of it. And when you fail, you know, you learn even more, so.
And you meet a lot of people, too.
How long have you lived in New York, Todd?
I moved here in 1997.
Okay. And your book, the title is Another, Photos of Another New York. You sort of shoot this, like, I don't want to say underbelly, but you might shoot things that the average New Yorker might not see. And it's sort of a popular topic to be like, oh, you know, New York is changing so fast and it's becoming this, you know, giant, glass-bound, homogenous, boring place. Are you of that mindset? I mean, did the photos you take in 1997, I mean, is that sort of undercurrent, that really electric undercurrent that you try and capture, is that still alive today, or is it harder to find? Or has it sort of moved somewhere else?
It's definitely still here. It might be getting harder to find, and it definitely shifts its locations. Maybe when I first moved here or even before that, it was probably more localized in like Alphabet City, Lower East Side, and now that's not the case. It's more in Brooklyn, but it's still going. And I kind of hope that the book does give people that sense. There's a lot of shots in the book from 2013. You know, I was shooting while I was editing. Some of that stuff is practically brand new. So it's definitely still happening. And, you know, I would also say that, you know, the rise of the condo is not, you know, overstated, but it doesn't mean it's going to kill it.
Well, my theory is just like it's like a breathing thing. So it's like as that expands, it pushes people to another area. And like you could argue that, you know, it's pushed people to the brink almost because, you know, the further you go out in Brooklyn, it takes you a long ass time to get into the city or Manhattan. But eventually that will curb itself because then, you know, you'll see the economy shift and things like that. And there'll probably be a downtime again, but then they'll find those pockets. And it's like I said, it's a living, breathing thing. I was happy to have both you guys on here because you guys are kind of like, you guys were starting right around the same time Impose was starting. So it's like, you know, to give people context, that means you're probably about like 52, 53 years old, somewhere in that ballpark.
About 14.
Okay. And but how did you, when I asked Todd, I was like, you know, who would you like to have as a musical guest on the show with you? He quickly said Japanther. So I was curious, how did you guys cross paths?
Oh, I answered an advertisement that Todd put up at a, we went to art college together, and there was an ad for a room, and then I lived in his front room where there was a chop shop next door, and they were taking the bolts off of cars like all night long, and oh, it was a funny place. But we paid really cheap rent, and Todd was, you know, doing photos and showing me how to use a scanner and helped me to make zines when we were you know, still 18-19 years old.
And where was this at the time?
Right there on Myrtle Avenue.
Oh, so it wasn't yeah. Brooklyn then?
Yeah. Yeah.
And have you been Brooklyn the whole time since you've been here?
You mean living in Brooklyn?
Yeah. Me too. Fuck Manhattan.
Yeah. I don't like to move, so I tend to just settle down when I can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except for when you're not in your house.
Well, there's traveling, which is different than moving.
Right.
I hate moving. I love traveling.
Yeah, no, I've never met anyone that enjoys moving.
Yeah.
I like moving. I moved about at least 20 times in my life. It's nice. Nothing is permanent. I think people in New York City are super New York City centric, even if you're from Brooklyn. Brooklyn's a part of Long Island, you know, and
right.
it's not such a glamorous place to be or as we make it out to be. So getting married to real estate or getting married to an apartment, you can waste whole years of your life. That opportunities that some of the best times I've ever had is when I don't have an apartment and you really have to make something happen. You know, the comfort of a home base is really a kind of a detriment to artists in my mind. So
interesting.
Yeah.
As you're talking to someone who rarely leaves his couch.
Yeah, you've been living in Park Slope for
You live
long
in
time.
Park Slope?
I do. Rent stabilized though, so you know, that's why that's nice. Part of the reason why I don't ever leave.
You got a baby and a stroller and shit.
Now see, I get in this argument with everyone because that's the assumption.
Yeah, it's
but cool. Greenpoint actually has a much higher baby rate than Park Slope.
Well, when did you move to Park Slope?
was like seven years
ago.
So
all those kids are grown up and shit.
That's the thing. They're all teenagers now. They're all in punk rock bands. They're Steve Buscemi's son. No. Now I'd lost my train of thought. What's the most crazy journey you've made? I can't remember this, but I remember when you were shooting with Team Robespierre. I think I remember you saying you did some like train hopping adventures, is that wrong?
No, I did a little bit of that with some friends. Yeah.
But what's the craziest adventure? And Ian, you can weigh in on this because you seem like you've had a little bit of a
troubadour spirit.
Yes.
Wow. Thanks.
Yeah. Well.
I think one of my crazy, perhaps, but one of my favorite trips that you actually already mentioned was doing the raft trip in Europe, sailing junk rafts from Slovenia over to Venice. That was amazing.
And how long did that physically take?
It was like 3 weeks of a
trip.
So
you were on the water for 3 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, there's a long process of building
before
you head out. We just kind of like set up in a... It was like a boatyard, and we were living out of shipping containers and building rafts. And then we traveled along the coast to Venice and then set up in Venice for a while because we would take the rafts around Venice and do performances. There was like a whole sort of loosely narrative play where all the rafts would tie together to make a long floating stage. And we would just pull up to the edge of Venice so people would just come along to the bank and watch the play.
I remember when I was in Amsterdam one time, they had someone doing something similar on the canal, doing a play. And it was November, but it was probably about 20 degrees outside, and someone from the play fell into the water.
Oh.
Yeah, it was, and then the like canoe like shifted off and like crashed up against the wall. It was kind of like a sad/funny experience. But then I just felt horrible for the person who fell in the water because it had to be so cold. That's kind of incredible. And there was also bands involved, correct?
Yeah, the band Dark Dark Dark
came
along to do the live score. Yeah, the whole project was a brainchild of the artist Swoon. So she designed the rafts that we built and invited a lot of other people to collaborate. And
what I meant by how long was the actual like rafting trip? Like you were putting kind of your life in the hands of the structure of these rafts, weren't you?
Yeah. the actual rafting trip was the 3 weeks. The build was probably a month. And then
did it even break down or anything like that? I'm not trying to
not terribly,
focus on the negative, but I'm just curious. That's kind of, I mean, it's a little bit scary. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we've actually done these junk raft trips so many times that breaking down has become a relative distinction. Lori, we didn't get stranded for a week, so we did good.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we didn't have some problems.
Right. And Ian, what about you? Do you have any? I mean, you just got back from Russia, right?
Yeah, we were just in Moscow and St. Petersburg. That was a really fun adventure. I think it's always exciting when you go places that people don't expect you to be, or places that are a little bit further out of the way. So I remember Mexico City being a beautiful place, and Juarez, Mexico, being a really cool place, and a lot of those border towns, the Spirit, Mexicali, they love when rock bands come there and they go absolutely crazy, and that type of energy is always. Such a welcome thing when you're traveling or when you're making any type of expression or art or politics or anything, when you get that feedback from an audience or from any type of energy, that when you arrive in Juarez, Mexico, and you realize that there's 250 people that want to jump off the stage because they've seen you on YouTube, it's exciting. It's a really exciting thing. So
do you feel that it's like, I mean, because the two you just mentioned, Mexico and Russia, there's kind of like this connotation of how either, difficult it is, whether, violence or even just like coming and going as like a as a traveler or a band or anything like that. Do you find that the people there are more receptive in that regard? Like the people who are there to witness you play are a little bit more appreciative of
there's certainly a level of increased appreciation, which is always exciting. But we feel great in New York City too, and we're excited to play for our friends here too. So I feel it's a gift anytime you get onto a stage and are given a microphone. So I take this opportunity, to really speak out and say that it's such a beautiful thing when you can play music or take photos or be a political journalist or be anything like that in order to enact change, in order to craft the world and into something that you want to see. And I think that's what artists truly should do, and truly the job of the artist is to craft a world that you envision and that you enjoy. So we love the opportunity to get on the stage at any point in time. We get a play up in Boston with Lightning Bolt on Friday night, which were, that's one of my all-time favorite bands.
Yeah, that'll be an amazing show.
Amazing energy coming out of Lightning Bolt. That's like one of the greatest American bands. So to witness them is great. you know, and on Saturday we play in Providence at another legendary place called Building 16, which used to be called, what was it, Fort Thunder? So those type of places and that type of American history, participating in American history is really beautiful thing to me. And to not get caught up in the idea of blogs, no offense to anyone, and to not be caught up in the idea of journalism, no offense to anyone, and not be caught up in the idea of photographs, no offense to anyone. But just get up caught up in the idea of just crafting a world that you enjoy and saying, oh, but then Todd wants to do this book and he's excited about it. Oh, support your friends and then we'll all be better off. So I would really just suggest that anyone kind of seek this idea out, and it's an inspiring book that's filled with some really beautiful images. So,
yeah, there are definitely a lot of great images in the book. I know there's some like random, not random, but like there's photos in there that are like the car on fire. Did you know that it was on fire, or did you just happen upon it? And things like that. There's images that speak to you in that kind of, you know, I don't want to say more important than other ones, but just kind of like more memorable. They just kind of like, they're things that you like point to as kind of like definitive in a certain way.
Well, the burning car, I happened to just get lucky, and that was on my street. So I was home cooking dinner when I heard the explosion, and I knew what that was because I'd been around cars getting burned before.
Right, right.
So I just grabbed my camera and ran out the door. So
I don't know what's been where.
That's
you
pure
knew
luck.
What it's saying.
Right place at the right time, that being your apartment.
Your apartment, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like there's some images that people are more attracted to as iconic, you know, kind of summarize something from the book, but part of the way I did the book I did is I wanted to create a sense of a place by this just piling on of images. A lot of them are very different or even contradictory. But I feel like that's a better reflection of the place. So I don't try to like sum up the book in like this image. It's more, I actually try to sum up the book in every image.
Well, I guess what I was getting at is there anything that's more personal or kind of like something that like strikes you more to like,
As like a mile marker in your life.
Yeah.
Or like a photograph when you can sort of point to and be like, that point in my life, I was doing this, and that's why this photo is special to me. I'm trying to translate Derek.
Yeah, I'm really bad at it. You guys are much more to the point than I
think I'm. There's a few bike kill photos that I've seen in there that maybe it's hard for Todd to say, but there's a few very iconic. I think it's like a guy that's wearing a bra that is like a... There's a few bike kill photos, like the Black Label bike kill, kind of some very wild, almost Burning Man-ish freak art culture that stand out as iconic to me in the book. So.
Yeah, I love a lot of the like crowd riding shots of a lot of like the old shows at Silent Barn and things like that, just because it kind of speaks to the nostalgia in what I like about Brooklyn, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's also, again, coming from the viewpoint of a 63-year-old man. So.
You had a photo up at the Culture Fix show of it looked like it was in a courthouse. But it was two portraits. One of them was of George W. Bush, and then Cheney is next to him. And then there's a security guard that's like motioning to you and yelling at you. What was the story behind that photo? Do you remember?
I used to work for an artist down in Tribeca, and that building is right by City Hall. I actually found out later. I think it's like an IRS FBI building. And I happened to just be walking by one day, and just looked in and saw, you know, these weird, these creepy dudes on the wall, you know, isolated. And so I kind of just had a little pocket camera, and I tried to lean over and get the shot, and I was really surprised. I could not get one shot before the guy saw me and was coming over, and I didn't stick around to have a conversation. I decided no.
Yeah, no, it's nice because their faces are so like cheesy and placid looking.
Yeah.
And it works with like the dynamic like arm and the guy sort of yelling at you.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Do you carry a camera with you all the time?
Yes.
I mean, you have to, right? I mean, that's just like...
Do you have to? Like, is there a time in your life where you didn't carry a camera around all the time?
Anytime I didn't carry a camera, I regretted it.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely think photographers work different ways. But a lot of the stuff in the book wouldn't be in there if I didn't happen to have a shitty point-and-shoot with me at that moment. So,
except for the burning car, you just totally blew a hole in my dream of this. You know.
What about what about the woman showing her tits to the one young woman and then the elderly gentleman? Where did that photo come from?
I used to go to some weird parties.
Yeah,
yeah.
But fun.
We're describing photos, so hopefully you go out and buy the book and look at the photos. So, but that one in particular was very good.
I have a question. Where does the fascination come from? Where you have to capture like. You know, every passing
that's a good
interesting
question
thing. Like, I I'm not a photographer, but I like to capture icons. I take a lot of pictures of graffiti, which because it's not a permanent thing. So that's my own obsession. So I've come to grips that I capture icons. Now, Todd's a photographer. He takes pictures of everything. Where does that obsession come from that you have to put things in a frame and take it away with you?
I guess I don't see it as like putting it in a frame and taking it away with me. Mm-hmm. It's more saving it so I can share it with other people.
Right.
And I definitely feel that it's not about capturing everything. It's about capturing certain things. But when asked what those certain things are, I honestly can only say, like, I just have an instinct that tells me. Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of, like, the random stuff on the street. Like, yeah, there's some dead animal thing. Why did I take a photo of that? I don't really know, but I saw it and it was like, oh, that's really interesting. You should capture that and try to capture it in a way that captures why you think it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the photographs I shoot, that's pretty much, I think, almost universally what I'm pursuing is trying to capture it in a way that conveys why I'm attracted to it or why I think it's interesting. If it's a crazy show, I want to be able to convey how utterly crowded, sweaty, insane, throbbing, loud, and bright everything is all at the same time. And that can be really hard, but I feel like it's a very worthy goal, and it keeps me pushing my work, because, you know, if you almost got it, you could still do better.
And can you trace the lineage back to one person that you looked up to? I remember a photographer that was, what's his name? It's Peterson is his last name, that did all the Sub Pop
albums. Charles Peterson?
Yeah, the great photographer, yeah. Charles Peterson. That was someone I looked up to when I was young, to those album covers. Is there someone that you look up to as you were growing and kind of that helped you to define and kind of flesh out this idea of saving these images?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting combination where there's been photographers that have definitely heavily influenced me, but I've also been able to watch what I'm attracted to shift and change. Like when I first moved to New York, I didn't shoot in New York. Like I barely took photos because I was still tuned into the Ohio landscape. And so I was looking for that in the city that didn't have it. And I was really frustrated. And it's actually partially what started me traveling so much was feeling that I couldn't shoot if I was in New York. And it took years for me to come around and finally start to recognize what was amazing and unique and interesting about this place. But I had to sort of relearn visually what I was attracted to and what the language was that was around me, because it was so different from what I was used to. And so I would say the photographers that influenced me at different times, depending on what I was tuned into. Mm-hmm. I'll probably never get away from the influence of William Eggleston, but I don't really want to. Todd Hedo is another amazing one, but it's interesting because those two photographers their work doesn't look anything like what it's in the book. It's the other side. It's the more Ohio
stuff. Todd Hedo is, the houses.
Yeah, the houses, yeah.
Beautiful stuff.
Yeah. But I think I'm attracted to them because they shoot essentially banal subject matter, but they make it amazingly captivating and imbue this narrative into it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is the mark of a great photographer. Mm-hmm. No matter what subject you're shooting or what your approach, if you can do that, that really sets you apart.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, like, you know, you see a lot of photos that just, you know, you're kind of, you look at it and you're like, you know, oh, what is that? That's just a picture. But, like, you know, you're taking something and just kind of putting a personality on anything and any situation is the beauty of a great photographer. Ian, what do you mentioned right before, we got to wrap it up. We got about 5 minutes left. So sure, you had mentioned before we played Stolen Flowers,
yeah,
that there's some new material on the way. I would like to find out about that.
Oh yeah, we're going to record some stuff in December and release it this February. So I'm excited to go out to Los Angeles and work with our producer out there on a lot of new tracks. Yeah, we're going to do some new videos out there as well. So yeah, always just keeping it new music. And as that industry kind of falls apart and changes, we're really excited to just maintain and keep releasing music for our friends and fans. And we feel so lucky to have an audience.
I think that's the most just kind of overlooked aspect of the music industry, is like everyone has this thought on what it is or like how it's, you know, falling apart or whatever. But in the grand scheme of things, like there's more people recording music and making music than, yep, and if maybe not than there ever was, but that we know about. And that's kind of the exciting part of it, is just like the discovery and the creation of it, you know. It's like what you were saying about just being creative with your time and you know, making the most of it. Do you have a, I guess maybe this is a little getting ahead of the game, but do you know who Ari's going to put it out?
Yeah, we have a label over there in Vienna, Austria that's called CU Records, and they treat us really well.
Nice.
Are putting like an international release out for us, which is exciting. And, you know, we just continue to work with kind of our friends and smaller labels that can give us personal attention. And
right.
Doing some tours in Europe and doing some tours in California and down in Australia and Asia this year. So really excited to just stay on the road. And, you know, seeing the world through a band point of view is a troubadour, as you might call it. Is one way of seeing it. It's not the best, but it certainly is a way where we can go and do it and also come home with a bit of a paycheck, which is nice to be a player, you know, like a basketball player or a musician is also a player. We feel gifted the way that a basketball player should feel gifted about playing with a ball.
I think in most people when they fantasize, I mean, obviously there's the few that are like, oh, I want to be a huge megastar. But I think most of the people in our world, when they fantasize about the world of being a musician, I think a lot of people actually fantasize about that aspect of it, like being able to see the world and tour. I think, I mean, and a lot of times it gets, I think people glorify it more than, than it, the life of a touring musician is hard, but at the same time, it's that's kind of the exciting part of being in a band.
Well, I would say that Vienna, Austria is my second home. We have friends there that are, we have five or six different friend sets there, from bike punks to, you know, fine artists to performance artists, and then gallerists, different types of people all over Vienna, Austria, and we feel so comfortable there. I can walk up and down that entire town and see 20 different people from different types of people. So to feel that in a place like Vienna is a wonderful thing. You know, Austria, we feel super, super welcome. Russia, we feel super welcome. All over the Eastern Europe.
Are you Eastern European?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, because Vanek is a popular hockey name.
That's right, Thomas Vanek is now, he was on the Sabres.
Sabres, I'm a Sabres fan, yeah. That's sad.
He's actually, he's an Austrian, actually. Eastern
Any Europe. Relation?
No, I wish.
Yeah, I know. I was going to ask you for an autograph.
It's like Smith, the name Vanek, Vanek. But, you know, places like Eastern Europe, which, you know, really only became westernized in 1989, are still really exciting. So I would just recommend that everyone try and get to those places and kind of experience that energy, because it's really beautiful, kind of non-Western energy and culture. We're pre-Christian Rome. That's my religion, is before Christ was born. People were really doing exactly what they wanted to do. So we're pre-Christian Roman. Shout out to my bandmate, Matt Riley. So,
yeah, I like it. Anytime I can kind of get a sports reference on, too, Chris gets cringes, but, you know. Well, guys, Ian, Todd, thank you again for joining us. We have to wrap things up.
You.
But before we go, let's just give another shout out. The show is tomorrow at Silent Barn.
That's right.
It's for Todd's book. Japanther's also playing, and for people who might be listening on the podcast, it's actually Thursday the 7th? Thursday the 7th, November 7th at the Silent Barn. Run down the bands one more time.
Japanther, So-So Glows, Unstoppable Death Machines, Ken South Rock, and Amor Obscure.
I have a feeling that's going to sell out, so you should get there early.
Yeah.
And prepare to sweat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aaron Short. Thank you. Chris?
I feel weird. I said tits. I never say tits. And I've just been playing that moment back in my head, but that's what's in the photograph. They're like tits, but I don't say tits because it's strange. All right,
I think that's about five times you said.
Yeah.
Well, I don't. It's not. I don't just toss that out.
You just did.
Yeah. Well, I guess I do.
Try and get one more in there.
Yeah. But let's end with that.
Okay.
All right. I thought you were going to say it one more time.
Oh no.
Have a good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.